You're listening to the Strong Towns Podcast.
Everybody, this is Chuck Marone. Welcome back to the Strong Towns Podcast. We often have people ask us questions about the role of philanthropy when it comes to building strong towns. People talk to us about how do we get philanthropy involved? How do we make really good investments? How do we access federal programs and kind of bigger resources to make strong towns work? This is a tension within our conversation. And I thought it would be really, really helpful to have some experts on this, some people that we're well aligned with, some people who are very interested in these issues on. Kelly Jin is the Vice President for Community and National Initiatives at the Knight Foundation. She runs a $150 million grant portfolio with $30 million annual in grant making in 26 Knight cities all across. Is it the United States or is it all of North America? I'm familiar with many of them, but I don't know your region. Kelly, welcome to the Strong Towns Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Chuck. And we are US-based, so these are all 26 Knight cities are here in the US.
I know Duluth is one of those, right? In my home state?
Yeah.
Yep. And places like Columbus in Georgia. I think Miami's one. Yep. I've come across them in my travels, and they are exciting places to be. Akron, Ohio is one that I interacted with, a beautiful place. Let me introduce our other guest. Stephen Goldsmith is the Derek Bach Professor of the Practice of Urban Policy, and he is the Director of Data Smart City Solutions Program at Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He also directs the Project on Municipal Innovation, the Civic Analytics Network, and in his spare time, the Mayoral Leadership in Education Network. Stephen Goldsmith, welcome to the Strong Towns Podcast.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
It's really nice to chat with the two of you. Kelly, I'd like to start with you. A lot of people ask about the role of philanthropy in building stronger cities, building healthier cities, building better cities. Can you just talk a little bit about maybe the Knight Foundation, your role, and how you look at philanthropy as a difference maker in community building?
Yeah, so you mentioned Miami. So we are based here in Miami, the Knight Foundation. We call ourselves a national foundation with local roots. And so you mentioned these 26 Knight cities. And the origins of Knight Foundation were that the Knight brothers in the early to mid 20th century actually ran a series of local newspapers across the country. And so they essentially took their wealth and placed it in the foundation. And today we are about $2.5 billion foundation doing roughly about $100 million a year in grant making. And I think for a lot of folks who have worked in government like myself or in community, I always feel like philanthropy is this like big black box of like, how does any of this stuff work and how do I get a grant? And Steve and I actually have known each other for now going on, I think, close to a decade. And I've been in and out of government and in and out of philanthropy over those years. But essentially, the role of philanthropy and how we view it is that there are incredible ideas and projects and leaders at the local level. And our jobs are to figure out, essentially, how do we support those ideas? And when it comes to very, very large infrastructure projects, and I'm sure we'll get into it on this conversation, how do we help kind of like seed those ideas that will take, we know, many, many years to actually take off if they're going to be transformative for our local communities? And so that's really the angle and lens that we view philanthropy is there's already amazing ideas out there. How do we uncover those and how do we support those? It's very, very different and juxtaposed with, I think, some other funders out there that take a much more technocratic approach to things, right? Like, we believe that things should be done this particular way. So we're going to like bet on who the winners are. We believe that this particular project should take off. And so we're going to fund that particular thing. And we believe that these are the solutions that should be happening. And that is very, very kind of the opposite of how we approach the world here at Knight Foundation. And one of the great pleasures that we have is really trying to support the local networks that exist out there. So that's a little bit more about the foundation, as well as our view of philanthropy and supporting local communities.
I've seen a lot of your work over time. I mentioned Duluth as one city here in my home state of Minnesota that I know is a Knight community. And, you know, obviously the difference or the needs in Duluth are very different than the needs in Miami where you are. Or I mentioned Akron earlier. Duluth might have more in common with Akron than with Miami. But even those two, the issues that they're dealing with are a lot different. How do you, in a sense, allow local partners to lead some of these conversations? You talked about identifying good projects and identifying good ideas. How do you actually go about doing that? And I'm thinking, you know, from our audience standpoint, how do I become a good idea? It's one of these things where, like, I've got lots of ideas, but sometimes communicating those to a foundation are difficult. What do you look for when you say good idea? And how would that be different in a place like Duluth or Akron than it would be in Miami or even Columbus or some of the other places you're at?
Yeah, I think you are spot on in really acknowledging the thing that took me a while, I think, as a funder to acknowledge, which is that communities are all different. Some project or idea that works in one particular place may not work in another place, and that may be for a whole bunch of different reasons. And so by design here at the foundation, we do have 8 communities, including Miami, where we have a local program director. And so kind of what is possibly better than someone who is local to Akron, Ohio, or Macon, Georgia, or here in Miami? I mean, literally, I hear stories from our local directors at the grocery store, and somebody is pitching them on a particular idea that they have about how to improve whatever the local community outcomes are. And so that is part of the design of the foundation in 8 of our markets out of 26. We've got a local director, and that helps a lot. In the remaining 18, we work really, really closely with our local community foundations. And so I actually think, and this is something that when I initially got into philanthropy, I wasn't too familiar with donor advised funds and community foundations, but Knight Foundation, we do partner across our 26 cities because we actually hold donor advised funds as well. And so we work through those CEOs and staff at community foundations, especially in those 18, to really identify what's happening locally. On the question about what is a good idea or what might philanthropy fund, I'll answer this in a couple different ways. I think the first is what's most important to us is that the idea is organic and true to what the local needs are. And we oftentimes have people who get really, really excited about something, but it's really their passion project, and it doesn't actually align to what's local. And so I'll just give you a kind of Minnesota example, specifically with St. Paul, actually, is that every time I go, I learn something a little bit more unique about the city and the downtown. And this last time I went back, folks were kind of teaching me about the origins of fashion and design in St. Paul, which had a lot to do apparently with that someone's going to fact check me out there in your audience, Chuck.
No, it's good.
apparently had to do with like something. It was like early 20th century. A police chief like made it okay for like people who were mafia members to come to St. Paul in the Twin Cities, and like he would
almost assuredly
them.
Yes.
He wouldn't like arrest them, and so therefore it became this haven for people to come to as long as they didn't commit crimes while they were there, and they like needed good clothes to wear. And so somebody was like literally describing that to me, and I think that's one of the most incredible parts of the job is that when we go local, we understand much more about the history of each of these communities. St. Paul there is just one example. Detroit and its rich history, like every Akron, every single one of these markets, we learn something that's really, really unique. And I believe that the best ideas are really springboards from something that connects back to the history of a particular community and what makes it special and unique compared to other cities across the country. The one other example that I'll give is specific to Macon, Georgia. So we went, actually all of our trustees, every year we pick one night city and we have our September board meeting there. And this past September in 23, we went, and one of these projects was basically, Macon has this huge, huge, just incredible music history about it. And we actually helped to fund the revitalization of Capricorn Studios there, which is where the Allman Brothers, you know, recorded their famous albums. And there's like a whole bunch of other Southern rock stories there. And I think like that is such a great example of, you have this asset that was from the mid 20th century was sitting, is basically dilapidated. Mercer University, local institution there, decided like, we're going to take this on. We're going to revitalize this space. But we're not just going to revitalize the studio. We're going to figure out how can we transform this space into a place nearby where tech companies can actually house some of their offices. There's residential development that's happening nearby. And then they've also figured out spaces for kind of next generation of musicians to come be able to take some of that magic and hopefully recreate it in the future with their recordings. And so that kind of like, okay, you've got an idea, but like, what's the soul of the idea and how does it connect back to your city and your community is critically important. And then I'll give you the one other lens here that's really important to us as Knight Foundation is, how are you going to sustain this? And I hopefully, Chuck, this is near and dear to your heart around larger government projects, but we may fund something. How is this going to work long term? What are the underpinnings of the business and the financials behind it? And so it's sometimes odd because people think philanthropy, they oftentimes equate it with charity, but just cutting a check to somebody and it being feel good is, I think, very, very different from the types of questions we're asking at Knight Foundation of how are you going to sustain those outcomes long term?
Yeah. Beautiful. Stephen, I want to talk a little bit about public infrastructure, because I hear the things that Kelly's saying about sustaining, about ideas being generated locally, about kind of this organic and authentic approach. I know you all held an infrastructure summit. I know you've all had conversations about how do we react to this very large, you know, federal infrastructure investment. What was the infrastructure summit that you all put together? What were some of the things that came out of that? And I think the mindset that you all are approaching this very substantial and I would say very touchy and tricky when, as it gets implemented, you know, federal dollars coming in on infrastructure right now.
Yes, thanks for the question. Let me lead up to it with a minute comment about Kelly's comments.
Go for it.
The role of philanthropy in catalyzing innovations in cities is invaluable. We have been fortunate to be a partner with Knight for 20 years, and Kelly's been a friend in and out of government, as she said, for a decade. You know, while I was mayor of Indianapolis, I depended on philanthropy for venture capital to restore neighborhoods. When I was deputy mayor of New York, we used not only Mike Bloomberg's philanthropy, but a whole range of others to kind of augment, not the traditional responsibilities of government, but the way government should interact with the community in order to build something better, right? And so, and I was chair of AmeriCorps. We were essentially a $1 billion philanthropy. We gave away money in order to improve communities. I start with that comment about Kelly's presentation because the infrastructure summit was not really just about infrastructure. You know, Knight's got a reputation as a philanthropy that cares about, a foundation that cares about community. So the question that we wanted to present was, okay, you've got a lot of federal money, so what? What are the best ways to think about investing that money, providing support to those cities so that they are not building, you know, you and I both have gray hair, Kelly doesn't, so because I know this is just a podcast, you don't want to build your father's Oldsmobile, right? That's not what you want to do with, you don't want to build your mother or father's sidewalk or six-lane highway. How do you spend this money to correct the inequities of the past and build communities for the future?
How do you do that? As I'm looking at the federal infrastructure bill, it feels like a lot of the momentum or the inertia is maybe a better way to put it, is behind building our father's Oldsmobile, you know, but doing kind of some of these projects of the past. How do you drive innovation when, in a sense, the money is almost flows easier to the older projects than I think the innovative projects? What's the role of philanthropic dollars and new ideas and all that in changing some of our federal spending?
So you want the 6-hour answer or the 2-minute answer?
Well, give me there. My understanding of your infrastructure summit was that it was designed to do just that. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I do feel like part of the concern was, if we don't step up and do something innovative, this money is going to be poorly spent. And so that there's a tension there. And I feel like you all are acknowledging the tension and trying to deal with it. I'd like to know what that looks like and what others can learn from that.
Yeah. So a great question. And I like to think that we were partners with the Knight Foundation to provide the thought leadership and collaboration that said, how are you going to use these dollars to build a sense of community? So let me first start by agreeing with your proposition. The natural tendency of government, including its procurement processes, is to do more of the same and to do it slowly, right? Both.
Yeah.
And I mean, and that also has historically built in a lot of inequity, right? I mean, one of the federal grants that Knight provided support for was the Reconnecting Communities Grant, as you're an expert on this, Chuck, which is to take out those ribbons of concrete that divided neighborhoods years ago, you know. And another set of Knight support was for a DOT project called SMART, S-M-A-R-T in capital letters. And Knight's interest in helping its cities with those grants is to say, let's not think about just curbs and just sidewalks. Let's think about their place in, you're a planner, I'm just a kind of professor politician, but what's their place in creating a sense of neighborhood? How do we manage the curb? How do we manage the sidewalk? So when those folks came together in DC, it was, okay, take the best examples from Knight cities. Let's look at the critical elements of what was a community collaboration. What was the role? We spent a fair amount of time on social infrastructure, so that how do you bring people out of their homes? How do you help them socialize, right? What are the aspects of a healthy neighborhood in terms of bike paths and, you know, grassy linear parks and regular parks? So just to back up to say, you can't really build a vibrant neighborhood with crumbling infrastructure, but nor can you build a vibrant neighborhood with just more infrastructure. And so that was the role of the conversation.
Yeah. Kelly, please.
What was really special to me about the conference and the summit that we pulled together was that we also kind of brought in leaders of major projects like the Beltline in Atlanta, basically like people who had done this hard work over the last 15, 20 plus years and had a good series of lessons learned to actually share with folks who, you know, were kind of like just sort of starting the planning process. And so being able to bring the Detroit Greenway and Riverfront folks, and as I mentioned, Atlanta Beltline, with some newer projects here in Miami, the crew that's trying to work on the Overtown Greenway here and other projects across the country. I think that is always really special, because as all three of us know, when you're deep in the midst of things working on the government project, it's really hard to open up the aperture and actually say, okay, but how do we learn from other folks who are doing this? And so we do think of that as one of the superpowers here at Knight Foundation. I encourage other philanthropies to think about this, which is, anytime you've got grantees or folks working on something, how do you bring them together on a regular basis so that they can discuss amongst each other and learn from each other, because nobody has all of the answers? I think that was really special. And then I think the other thing that was really special that I kind of learned through the summit is actually bringing former federal officials in who can now say whatever they would like about the current administration and advice to the local communities. We had Anthony Fox, former mayor of Charlotte and U.S. Department of Transportation secretary, speak very vividly to our communities to give advice exactly on, hey, when you're applying for these funding streams, be clear on what are the community outcomes that you are seeking to improve and support. And I think one of the best bits of advice that applies for philanthropy at large as well, which is don't presume that the funders know everything. You know everything because you're in community working on this. So tell the federal government, tell the funders like Knight how the work needs to get done in order for you to benefit communities and community outcomes as well. And so I thought that was a lot of the magic of this, is like you had all these like practitioners and people doing a lot of hard work on the ground, being able to take a step back for a day, 2 days, and say, okay, like how do we be most strategic about these projects long term? And what do we need to be thinking of in order to get that to happen? I think those are the dividends that I'm hoping, and we're starting to see it, we'll see that pay off in the next 5, 10+ years.
I want to ask both of you about equity and how it fits into this, because you both have mentioned it, and we have struggled at Strong Towns with, I think, some of the contradiction between the urgent needs that we experience and run into, which are very kind of block level and bottom up. And when we talk equity, we're really talking about the lived experiences of people on the ground. And the way that federal money and at times philanthropic money flows through communities in larger projects, the latter being having a more difficult time doing kind of the nuanced work that often equates with more equitable work. I see a lot of people, and I think with big hearts and good intentions, having a project in mind and then describing it in terms of equity instead of starting with an urgent need and then trying to find a project that fits that. When we're talking about large financial flows and federal dollars and big programs and all this, what does equity mean to you in that context? How do you have outcomes that align with your values? And I don't know which one of you wants to start first with that. Stephen, is kind of your turn. So maybe I'll start with you if you don't mind. And then Kelly, I know you've got some ideas too. So Stephen, would you mind starting with that?
Does that mean she gets the last word or what?
What's well, you we can go, you can talk.
All right. Well, yeah, big question and not a simple answer. We've been paying a considerable amount of time with Knight and others on questions of place-based equity. There's lots of definitions of equity, but let's think about it in terms of a place. And then you can divide the answer to your question into a couple ways, I think, or actually several. One would be, how about if we just stop doing bad stuff, right? That's one way to think about equity, whether that's a highway that goes through your neighborhood, or there are cities doing some pretty sophisticated mapping. Esri's got a spatial equity index. Tucson and Tacoma in particular have equity indexes. San Diego as well, San Jose, that look at infrastructure expenditures to see where it's fairly done, right? So correct neglect in the past, maybe a park or the like. That's another way to think about it. But a more complex and important way, which I think is what Kelly led us to in this conversation you mentioned before, is how do you bring together all of the elements necessary so that you have a built environment conducive to a neighborhood that works? So that would mean that, particularly today, if you thought a lot about IoT sensors, so what's the air quality in a neighborhood that's historically ignored? And what's causing bad air quality? And how does that affect the health of children? Well, so when you invest in your infrastructure, maybe you think about health quality as well. How about social infrastructure? We spend a fair amount of time on social infrastructure. Knight's got some terrific examples of funding in Miami and other places of social infrastructure. And we have demonstrations, as you know, Chuck, because you're an expert in it, where people come out of their homes and they socialize more, it produces better benefits, jobs and school and the like. So a third way to think about equity is, how do we think about comprehensive neighborhood redevelopment in the communities that have been historically disadvantaged or ignored, and build that infrastructure that produces these positive externalities, if you will. So those are all ways to think about equity, and we touched on many of them in our work with Knight.
Yeah. Kelly?
I always kind of go back to Raj Chetty's study on economic mobility. At this point, it's probably 10 years ago. And think about just the fact across all of the communities, like depending on which block you grow up in or live in, which zip code, you're likely to have completely different outcomes over your life. And so, and this is piggybacking off what Stephen shared, that is what I think about when I think about infrastructure, right? Like the ability, and I've literally walked the streets of so many of the Knight cities and a lot of the neighborhoods that we've supported and their own efforts, Black and Brown communities, to figure out ways to reconnect like neighborhoods that were literally divided in half, like Chinatown and Philadelphia. And like you have a very visceral experience that you're standing on one side, there's an entire highway or expressway, and like you barely have enough time to make it to the other side before the light turns the other color and you're gonna get run over by a car. And so I think about that lived experience on the ground pretty consistently across all of our cities. And so when you then layer on the infrastructure projects and a lot of these big ones that the feds are supporting, I think you're right, Chuck. Like people are like, yeah, we're gonna incorporate equity into it. And then like it kind of just falls down from there, right? It's like, oh, we'll do some reporting about how we did the procurement and do we have diverse vendors, like all that. And for me, I think you just have to go back to the community outcomes. Is there a difference in the economic benefit from this neighborhood to this neighborhood? And I think when we talked about these, a lot of these reconnecting community projects, I'll never forget, we had a conversation with our CEO and, you know, we're excited. We're going to have these bridges and caps of highways are going to happen. And our former CEO, Alberto, stopped us in the middle of his presentation and said, we're actually talking about decades of disinvestment. So how are we going to fix everything on the economic side? Because this is actually about businesses and jobs and people's livelihoods. I had this aha moment, this was like 2 years ago, where that's actually what all of this is about at the end of the day. It's not actually about the, well, maybe it is, and we can debate this. It's not actually about the road that's getting torn back up or maybe beautified and putting in green space, but it's actually about the human experience and like the family experiences of folks who are actually living there. And so that's how I think about all of this. And specifically when it comes to planning, I don't know how much more we could possibly do at this point, but to ensure that any type of planning process, even if you think you're helping somebody, anything should not be designed for a group of people or a certain block or neighborhood without deeply engaging them in that process of design for the future. And that's something that I think we come back to again and again at Knight Foundation is any of these projects that we're funding in Akron specifically, helping to support the Summit Lake neighborhood revitalize, and there's a lot of public housing nearby. Like you have to build in the community engagement elements of that. So again, a lot of different ways to think about equity, but for me, it always comes back to what are specifically the community outcomes that we're supporting and how do we make that better?
So Knight has, as you said, a number of regional directors. I got to know Kyle. I always screw up his last name, but I think it's Kuduchief.
Kuduchief, yep.
Kuduchief, okay, great. In Akron, who is from Akron, loves the place, is like deeply in love with the place, deeply passionate about it. And I walked a lot of the neighborhoods with him and with other people. And you kind of get this, because Akron is a place, much like my hometown here in central Minnesota, it's a place that has really struggled in a lot of fundamental ways. And you'll walk down the street and you'll see sidewalks that are in total disrepair and places that are disconnected. And in my estimation, you'll see 1,000 small projects that need to be done. And I think the Knight Foundation, to me, I mean, I watch Kyle work in these places, and a lot of what his emphasis was empowering people who would actually deal with those. But there's also this tension, because when the money comes in, particularly when it comes through the federal government, oftentimes when it comes through philanthropy, it's really hard to do 100 small projects. It's almost easier, or there's less tension, or there's, you know, a cynic would say a bigger ribbon cutting and a bigger, you know, marketing effort. But I think even non-cynically, you can look and say there's more momentum and less friction in doing a significant kind of, we're going to do this project and it will change other things, as opposed to really changing those other things. How does that tension play with you, both of you? And I kind of go back to that equity discussion. How do you deal with on the ground, or as you think about these large capital flows coming in to a community, how do you address that tension between what would clearly be like a bottom-up local need that would have a strong equity component, and what I think is maybe an easier project to pull off and do in terms of a larger pot of money? Kelly, you want to start with that? You get where I'm going with this?
Yeah, I do. The most plain way of opening up my comments is like, change is actually really hard. So to this point of like, you know, smaller projects, maybe more iterative in their structure versus larger projects, I actually go back to thinking about where a community is on their shared collective vision and what are effectively the levels of trust and bonds that exist across the leaders and the residents in any particular place. I do believe that there is definitely a place for innovation challenges trying to activate a whole bunch of different entrepreneurs, kind of generally defined, not specifically those who are starting businesses, and helping to support them to get small ideas off the ground and going. Specifically in Akron, the Inner Belt, which is this decommissioned road that basically just like, and you've seen it, Chuck, like it just stops.
Yes.
And
very sad. Yep.
Anybody who goes to take a run around the downtown and the nearby areas is really jarring, because you're like, well, it's like this kind of this like the weird road that's there. And I think what's so interesting is that the road's been there for a while, just decommissioned. And what they did is, I can't remember how many years ago, probably 6 or 7 years ago at this point, they pulled together the local communities and residents, and they actually did dining along the road. Like, they put up tables and had people eat and kind of envision what the future might look like. And these were like really small funded projects that Knight Foundation helped to support. That project was called 500 Place. Today, you know, there has been this increasing momentum over time. They received close to $1 million from the U.S. Department of Transportation on actually making concrete these planning efforts for how do we re-envision what the future of that space might be. And this used to be a bustling Black neighborhood in, you know, very close in the downtown of Akron. And so I think about sequence as it comes to this question, which is when you have these big funding streams, you're likely going to have some projects that make sense. You've done the engagement. They're shovel ready, one of our favorite terms in local communities and governments, and we're ready to go. But then you probably also have an entire series and set of other projects that are just kind of like, you're not really sure what they are yet. Somebody's got an idea, and maybe it's like a wild, crazy idea, and putting down a little bit of money there can help somebody get going. We've got one very good example here in Miami. Our metro rail runs about 10 miles, and underneath it has just been ugly concrete and people avoiding walking underneath it for many, many years. Meg Daly, the founder of Miami Underline, she basically, this is kind of a strange yet interesting story, she unfortunately had broken both of her arms and so could not drive in Miami.
Wow.
And she was riding the rail and one day looked up and said, well, why isn't there, what, couldn't there be a beautiful public space that's underneath the Miami metro rail? And fast forward today, you know, this is a $150+ million project, fully funded. Government and private sectors have pitched in. But Knight Foundation was the first $10,000 check for that idea. And like, you know, fast forward 10 years later, it's an actual giant infrastructure project here locally that we can actually benefit from. So that's the way that I think about this is, there's a time and a moment where you're doing the smaller checks to help get something going. And there's a time and a moment kind of for these larger projects, depending on the phase of where they're at.
Yeah. Jane Jacobs talked about cataclysmic money. I'm kind of sensitive to this idea that we can go into, I think of some of those neighborhoods in Akron, we can go into some of these places that have long been neglected and say, all right, catch up time. And you wind up doing things that either dislocate people or are not responsive to kind of the needs that are on the ground right now. How should we think about this idea of cataclysmic money? How do we scale it correctly so that we get outcomes that are aligned with our values?
I've been working on this answer to this question for about 3 decades.
Yeah.
So I want to tell you about something I did as mayor of Indianapolis that then Knight funded me to run a program at Harvard about that ended up in a book that addressed the question. I'll do all that in 4 minutes.
First
of all, everything Kelly said, of course, I agree with. Let me focus my answer to your question on neighborhoods that have historically been the most neglected, either the subjects of redlining or historical disinvestment or all of the rest of those things. What do you do? And the reason I gave you kind of my flip answer to begin with is that I got elected mayor. I'm so old. When I got elected mayor of Indianapolis, I went out to Baltimore to meet with Kurt Schmoke and Jim Rouse, who, since you're a planner, you'll know of kind of his fame in terms of redeveloping cities. And we went through 2 or 3 neighborhoods in Baltimore that he had decided with Mayor Schmoke he was going to rebuild totally, with, you know, because he was a philanthropist with enormous amounts of money. And one question was, what are we going to tell everybody else, which I want to come back to, because I think that's a pretty important question as well, because any mayor or even any philanthropy thinks that they're going to rebuild their city is ridiculous, right? So it just has to be kind of targeted investments, or you tend to kind of dissipate. And so then I went back to Indianapolis and I picked 8, where I was mayor, picked 8 neighborhoods of 8 to 20,000 people each and decided I wanted to, which neighborhoods had been the most neglected since World War II, and decided I was going to do everything possible to rebuild them. But for me, everything possible was the city does its infrastructure work. We support the capabilities of neighborhood leadership. We do a neighborhood training academy. We do social infrastructure. We look at where the neighborhood assets are, all the asset mapping that we all know so well. Looked at the local faith-based organizations. At any rate, so you then have a map of the ecosystem. You know where the infrastructure needs to be invested. You know which neighborhood groups need to be involved, and you go forward. And then you do micro-enterprise, all the rest of the things, transportation as well. And now I did those 20 years as quickly as I could. Let me slow down for a second. So there's a couple of principles there. One is that I don't think the issue is whether you do little projects or big projects. It's whether you invest sufficiently in some area that you catalyze sustained reinvestment and confidence, right? Just the job of a mayor, or maybe the job of Kelly as a philanthropist, is to get to a point where people who live in a neighborhood that's been ignored have confidence that tomorrow will be better than yesterday, because generally it's not, and they don't think it will be. And when they do think it will be, then the investment is long-term and sustained, because they'll invest themselves or stay in the neighborhood or the like. So I think it's taking a discrete area and involving the community and doing the range of activities, some big, some small, that produce a sense of enthusiasm. Now, there's lots of pieces to that, housing and parks and transportation, but I think you need to take a comprehensive view of it, or you're going to waste the money.
Yeah, we call it a bank run on confidence. Some neighborhoods just need to be assured that the bank is stable, that their neighborhood's stable, that it will turn around. Both of you have experience within government. And, you know, at Strongtowns, we have this saying that local government is the highest form of collaboration in a community, not the algae in a food chain of governments, right? It's not the lowest form of government. It's the highest form of collaboration. If you go into a lot of city halls, the orientation within city hall is very vertical. It is, what's the state program we can tap into? What's the federal program? Who's the developer we can bring in? Where do we get outside capital? And oftentimes they struggle to align horizontally. What's the urgent need in the neighborhood? What's the thing that we need to be out on the ground doing? Ideally for you, both in a federal investment standpoint and in a philanthropic standpoint, what does a good local government look like? What is a really successful city? How are they aligned? How are they thinking? What's their attitude? What's their approach to you? Because a lot of cities right now today are very desperate. I mean, they're stretched really, really thin. They have more promises than they have wealth. They struggle to make ends meet. They have a ton of pressure on them. If you're going to partner with someone, if we're going to deploy federal dollars somewhere, what is a really good local government look and act like and feel like? What's their attitude and approach? And Stephen, I'll start with you.
So city government has a parks department, a public works department, a transportation department, a planning department. But people don't live in the parks department. They live at 10th and Main, right? They don't live in a department. In both of my mayoral jobs, I was always confused why everyone in city government was assigned to a function. Nobody was assigned to a place. Essentially, nobody was assigned to a place. So you have to change that. That's point one. Point two is...
That's a genius point, by the way.
Well, thanks. But and even the perspective that inside government is insufficient, right? Because we do a lot of work with mayors, and we try to show the mayors how they should be experts in governance, not government, because you can't solve any problem. Even if you got cross-agency collaboration around place, you're still not going to have sufficient resources without nonprofit sector, for-profit sector, philanthropic sector. So what's the foundation to bring those folks together? So I would say that, and any big problem today, every major problem today in the U.S. is a multi-sector, multi-jurisdictional problem. It's not a singular thing. Whether it's workforce, economic mobility, or child welfare, or the like. So, in summary, we actually need to reorganize government, and I think generative AI will help it. But particularly, I think that a mayor, and Bloomberg has supported chief innovation officers that have helped a little bit in this regard. A mayor needs to organize around places and challenges, not around departments. Create the task force, provide the data infrastructure so you really know what's going on, the benchmarks and outcomes that you can measure month over month and year over year, and have somebody in charge at the top. Otherwise, the agencies will spend forever negotiating with each other.
It does feel like there are no more simple problems, right? We're only dealing with complex. Kelly, please.
Both Stephen and I worked in the 400,000 person organization that is the city of New York. And so I think we both still have the scars from how do you move and shift thinking and culture and actually get things done. I think these days I've come back to management and leadership. And I know Steve mentioned, appointment of chief innovation officers and the like. I just come back down to the actual management and leadership experience of agency heads. And so typically what happens is you'll have some incredible, mayor who's got a vision and comes in ready to go. They immediately get hit in the face by all of the urgent and important things. And for, I think, a community and for a local elected to be successful, they have to focus on the not urgent, important things strategically long term. Instead, we spend the vast majority of your time, my time, reading the front page of the New York Post. And literally, that would be what me and my team was handling for that day or for that week, was the crisis or the emergency of the moment. And so for me, that's what it comes down to, is around management and leadership and making sure that we can build a bench. Because also, you know, in many ways, trying to convince people, how do you actually build the pipeline into government? That's something that Knight Foundation has continued to support now for about 14 years. We helped to support Code for America to bring more techies into local city halls. We've supported Coding It Forward's expansion, which is early career folks straight out of college to get them some exposure to stay in local governments. But I think this is just super, super important, is just not forget. There's all these things that you can do, but not forget that it actually comes down to the leaders that you actually have in place. And then the second thing I would say is that I also think in the successful Knight cities, we've continued to see local community members, CBOs, leaders who are able to figure out how do you locate the center of gravity outside of government when it comes to a community vision or like plan for change and transformation. Because I've just seen again and again, and I've lived it myself, the end of administration, we say, oh no, like none of this stuff will carry into the next administration. So whether it is a plan for the downtown into the future, how can you house that outside of government, seeing that government is an actor in that? But your mayor and your local elected shouldn't be the only figurehead for that future vision, because by the time somebody new comes in, they're probably going to want to scrap that and have their own vision for the future.
Yeah. I know we're running out of time. I want to ask, Stephen, I know you have a passion for data and applying data. And Kelly, you just brought up tech. It does feel like part of doing more with less is going to involve applying better tech, better data, better insights to cities. There's also the signal and noise problem that we all face when we get into this. Who's doing this well? How should we think about this? What is the role of data? And Stephen, maybe you could start, and then Kelly, we'll end with you. Stephen, what is the role of data for running a modern city government?
I'm going to be careful here because Kelly was the chief data officer for the city of New York, so she's slightly more technical than I am. So I run a program. I get to put a commercial in here for the Data Smart Please. City Solutions at the Harvard Kennedy School, Data Smart Civic Solutions. Look it up. We have about 200 use cases on how to use data to solve these problems. So that's my commercial. It's relevant to my answer to your question. Let's connect your last set of questions with this question. So yeah. As you think about the complex cross-sector collaborative problems, they're going to require data insights. So why is somebody homeless? Well, they don't have a home. They don't have a job. They don't have a bus ticket. They're victims of domestic violence. They have a mental illness issue. They have a substance, right? So what is the data show about where the people are and what the needs are? I can do that exercise with almost anything, right? Which is to say, if you don't have accurate data about the causes of your problems, then you can't effectively solve those problems. We run programs with chief data officers. Kelly at one time was part of those. And whether it's spatial visualizations or data analytics, data ought to be the foundation. And just to finish, because I know we're out of time and Kelly has much more to say on this than I do. If you have these complex collaborations, some intermediary, to take Kelly's last answer, in the community needs to run a platform that brings the data together, uses a common kind of taxonomy, and allows the parties to see that data, where the needs are, what the problems are, what the solutions are. So for us, in the work we do at DataSmart, data is the driver of these solutions and increasingly of the collaborations themselves.
Kelly?
I feel like I've always had jobs where nobody understands what I actually do for a living. So when I was in New York, I decided that when I was giving talks and keynotes, I would like actually explain. I was like, what on earth does it mean to lead this team and work on data analytics at the city? And, you know, basically broke down the four chunks of what it means to do analysis and use data. And it all has to do with problem solving. So number one, what is actually happening out in the world? Number two, why is it happening? Number three, what's likely going to happen in the future based off these trends? And then number four, the hardest part of all of this, what on earth should we do about it? And so for me, I think back to my earlier point just now on management and leadership, it's ensuring that you have leaders in place in government, outside of government, who are able to ask and answer these questions using data as essentially a tool and fuel for that. But I think it has to come from the local electeds and agency heads to be able to have that fluency to ask these types of questions. Because what you end up having is a whole bunch of incredible data scientists and people like ready to crunch the numbers. And I'll never forget our wonderful data scientists on the team would always just look at me and say, you know, if someone just give me like the perfect data and the perfect questions, I could do anything. And I said, you're never going to get either of those things sitting down, you know, with folks working in government. All you're going to get is really messy data and not fully constructed questions, right? Like your job is to help translate around this. Out of all of the night cities, I think probably the accolades would go to San Jose. Should be kind of no surprise to anybody here, San Jose, Silicon Valley. There are a lot of folks who are quite exceptional on the data, digital, and technology front there. And what San Jose has done over the last couple of years is to make sure, like Steve mentioned, that there's actually capacity in place, people whose jobs specifically are to answer these types of questions and also to intersect data analytics technology with equity. And so I think San Jose has done an exceptional job when it comes to the uses of AI and ethical principles. They are also leading the pack on how government should be using AI, but then also engaging alongside community to define what those principles are. It pains me to say it because I've always lived on the East Coast, but I would advise folks to look to San Jose and the West Coast for some leading frames around all of this.
Kelly, I know the website is knightfoundation.org. If there's other people who want to follow your work, follow the work of the Knight Foundation, is there a good place for them to plug in, a good place for them to land? Is the website the best place to start?
Yeah, the website is the best place to start. I am pretty active these days on LinkedIn. I have left X or whatever version of X or
whatever it's called now. Yeah.
That we still want to call it these days. And Steve and his team are also pretty active in case, Steve, you wanted to plug your Twitter handle.
I would love to. Steve, where can people follow your work?
I think probably best the Harvard website, Data Smart City Solutions, or as Kelly, I'm active on LinkedIn and less active on X as Goldsmith on Gov. So we have lots of case studies, lots of learnings, including several that feature night cities, eager to tell people about them.
Stephen Goldsmith is with the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Kelly Jin is with the Knight Foundation. Thank you both. It's been a very healthy, good discussion. I feel like I learned something, and I'm sure our audience did too. Thank you for taking the time, Kelly. Stephen, very nice to meet both of you.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
And keep doing what you can to build a strong town. Take care, everybody. We'll talk again soon.
They know that America's one big pothole right now.
Bill, 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 Bill. That's the story.
Chuck Marone, this has been fascinating.
Who made the city?
I like you. I like your vision of the world.
The United Nations Earth Summit, Agenda 21. Yeah.